Houston, Dinah, Portland, Timbers, Sporting, Kansas, Los Angeles, Galaxy.
Beach Pass.
This is my
Toronto, FC,
Real
Salt Lake.
This is my red, white, and blue.
Chicago Fire.
This is my
York Red Bulls.
Pitch Pass, your all-access credential to the people that matter in MLS. Here's your host, Greg Roach.
Hi, welcome to another edition of the show, and I appreciate it, as always, for you taking the time to download and listen to the show. Would appreciate it even a little bit more if you would tell some friends about the show. PitchPass.com is the first place you want to point them to because that's where everything is housed. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at PitchPass. And if you want to leave some comments, some ratings on iTunes, you could do that as well. We appreciate that. Later on in the show, SI.com's Brian Strauss will join us to talk about Minnesota United, the story that he broke, maybe possibly coming to MLS soon. We'll get into the Eddie Johnson situation a little bit, and we'll talk NYCFC as he was in the house for their opening match last weekend at Yankee Stadium. But first, the team that has come sprinting out of the blocks initially for the first 2 weeks of MLS 2015 has been FC Dallas. 6 points from two games. Well, they'll take that. And one of the big reasons is their stout defense. And one of the stalwarts of the FC Dallas defense joins us right now on the show. I'm talking about Matt Hedges. Matt, how are you, my friend?
Good. How are you doing, Greg?
How are things in FC Dallas? Well, pretty good, I would imagine, after the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, I can't complain. I mean, we're off to a great start, 2-0, top of the league. So, yeah.
I guess the question as we watch these matches, you know, it's hard to take a lot of away from early season matches, especially in a long slog of a season like MLS is. But I know as a player, you're going to give me the standard line. Points are points, whether they come in March or whether they come in September and October.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, to pick them up now is even more important because there's going to be stretches where we're going to struggle. Every team does in the league. It happens every year. And to get as many points as possible early in the season is smart. Because, I mean, especially for us in Dallas, the last 2 years in the summer months, we got into a rough patch. And it was a good thing we picked up points early in the season, because if we didn't, we would have been in a rough spot.
Well, let me ask you, you guys have been home the first 2 weeks. Is that any more of an advantage than some of the other teams who maybe have had one home match and have travel, or maybe two matches where they've had to travel, like TFC? You guys have been home. Does that matter at all for you guys?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, we're a great team at home. Obviously, in the last 12 games, we think we've won 10 of them at home. So to get two games in a row at home at the beginning of the season, we felt like that needed to be 6 points for us. And, in travel and all that, that's another big advantage. So, yeah, I think playing at home is always an advantage in this league.
I was wondering, and I'm glad you kind of confirmed it, because for me it feels like, okay, preseason is over, but now you do get another 2 weeks in your home, your comfortable surroundings. It almost is like an extended time to work on some extra things.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
However, I guess this would make this even a more important situation. 5 of the first 7 matches for FC Dallas are at home, so I guess it is even more important to get off to that fast start while you've got these home matches, because you know the road matches are going to start evening out towards the end.
Yeah, those road matches are going to start piling up, and I think home matches, whenever they are, they need to be 3 points for us, so it doesn't matter if they're at the beginning or in the middle or whenever. So, yeah, we just need to get those points now before we start getting into a big stretch of maybe 5 road games in a row. So,
first road match is this Friday in Philly. You think of a guy who plays for FC Dallas, automatically, if you don't know much, you think to yourself, okay, this is a Texas guy. But actually, you are kind of East Coast-ish from Rochester, did some time in Indianapolis. Coming to Philly is not a homecoming, but I know you did some time in beautiful Reading, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I did. I mean, but I lived in Philadelphia for 10 years, actually, after I lived in Rochester. Now, so it is kind of a homecoming.
Right.
I do know a lot of people there.
Break it down for me, Matt Hedges. What did you do ending up in Philadelphia, and where in Philadelphia were you? Because I'm a Philly boy myself.
I only lived in Rochester for a year after I was born there, and so I don't really remember that. But then we moved to Philadelphia, and I lived in Yardley. I don't know if you know.
No, I do. You know Yardley, right on the other side, northeast side of Philadelphia.
Yes, sir, and that's where I lived for 10 years. I played soccer for YMS. I don't know if that's still around or not. I haven't really paid much attention to that. But, yeah, for 10 years, I was a Philly guy.
And then where did you move to from there?
From there, I went to Indianapolis.
Got it. Okay, so that's where your indie roots come from, is that move after the Philly move.
Right.
So how do you end up back in Reading then, as you kind of do your vacations from summer and school?
The Reading coach actually got in touch with my college coaches, and they were looking for guys to send out there. I thought it would be a good opportunity. I was from the area, or from kind of
yeah.
Reading is kind of close enough that I would know the area maybe. And they had been one of the best teams in PDL, and I thought that was another way to increase my stature in soccer was to be one of the best summer league teams.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you how you end up in Reading, and now it kind of makes a little bit more sense. But as a young guy, you were probably late teens at that point. What was Reading like for you? Because Reading is not Philadelphia, and at that point, your family had already left the Philadelphia area.
It was a good experience for me to get out and kind of live on my own for a while and get a small taste of what the world's going to be like after you get out of college and you start playing soccer full time. I think, I had some jobs there too. So it was a pretty cool experience. And I would encourage other players to get out and do that as well.
Oh, what does a Matt Hedges do as a summer job while he's in Reading, Pennsylvania?
I actually built above ground pools.
That sounds glamorous, Matt.
What?
That sounds glamorous.
It was not glamorous, but I actually kind of enjoyed it. Manual labor, I've never done it before, but it was pretty interesting. I got to work with some pretty cool tools, and I got to be outside. It wasn't all bad. I kind of liked it.
Okay, so did you build the actual pool, or did you build the deck around the pool that makes it, if you didn't know better, it looks like a regular pool, only it's above ground? Which one did you build?
The actual pool.
Whoa! All right.
Yeah.
Now, does Reading United get you hooked up with this job? Like, how do you think to yourself, I've never built anything before, I'm going to build above-ground pools this summer?
The guy was actually a fan of the team.
Oh, okay.
And, he needed some guys to work for him, so I guess they got in contact. And, I still keep in touch with him. When I go out to Philly this week, I'll probably say hi to him and try to do something. But, no, it was cool.
That's pretty fun, actually. You learn
you
learned a trade, building above-ground pools.
Yeah.
So
do what you gotta do.
Let's talk about some things that you do in your free time now that you are a professional athlete. And I'm thinking specifically about your gaming habits. Now, are you're a PS guy, right?
No, I'm Xbox, actually.
I was going to bond with you because I just got a PS4, and I thought you were a PlayStation guy, but you're an Xbox guy. Here's a question for you, then. What went into your decision to go Xbox over PlayStation?
I've always, my first gaming console was an original Xbox, and that was kind of
okay.
What started it, but I got Halo was my first game, and that was it. Like Halo,
yeah.
I had to have every Halo, and I had to play every Halo, and so Xbox was the only way I could do that.
Yeah, once you're on that train, you're an Xbox person until they kick you off at some point.
Yeah, basically.
Because my kid...
Because right now I'm playing the new Master Chief Collection basically all the time, and I can't get me off of it, so it's awesome.
You're playing the new what?
The new Master Chief Collection.
Oh.
It's like all the Halos into one game. Yeah.
So you put the sports game aside, now you're testing your brain out.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me, like, oh, you play FIFA all the time? I was like, honestly, no. I, rarely play FIFA. I don't have the new FIFA for any system, so it's kind of... A break from soccer when I get on video games.
Really? So no FIFA for Matt Hedges. So if I asked you right now your FIFA Ultimate Team score, you would have no idea what it is.
Well, hey, I wouldn't say that. I definitely know what that is.
Let's not go that far, Greg. I'm plugged in. I just don't play that much.
Yeah, exactly.
Your thoughts on your score right now? Your ranking or your number?
You always wish it was higher.
Of course.
It's not so bad.
Well,
I can live with it.
What areas do you feel like they kind of they knocked a couple of points off of you that probably shouldn't have been knocked off?
I feel like my ball control is really low. Like, just because I'm a center back on FIFA doesn't mean I have to be terrible with the ball at my feet.
Yeah, and I think they do that because you're a center back and because you're American. I think they feel like they got to dock you points and nobody's going to say anything because of those two things.
That's probably a pretty accurate assessment of what's going on there. But, I mean, you look at it, it's like, geez, you could have at least given me a couple more points.
And I always think to myself, what do you need to do to get that number higher, like in real life, that would then translate to your FIFA score being higher?
That's another thing I'm wondering. I'm like, how do they come up with these scores? Do they watch every play, or do they just kind of go, oh, that guy's a center back?
Exactly.
Dallas, we'll just give them a 55 at this stat. It's like,
exactly.
Dude, I don't even watch for this stuff.
Exactly. But I think maybe with the cap now, they go, oh, he's got a cap. Here's an extra point across the board.
That'd be nice. I'll take it.
Exactly. So speaking of your first cap, I have to ask you how it breaks down, because I know this is one that you've been waiting for, this phone call that you've been waiting for a while, and that is the call into national team camp. I talked to Stephen Keel early last year, and we talked about your national team prospects, and he was like, if he doesn't get a cap sometime in the next year, I'm going to be really shocked. It ended up happening, not in the way that I guess that you thought, in that you were called in after Brad Evans left. How good a shape are you in? And I'm not trying to open up the controversy again with Klinsmann, but when you get the phone call, is there any thought in your mind going, oh my gosh, I didn't have a chance to prep for this. I'm maybe not in the shape that I would be if I had known 2 months ago that this was going to happen.
Actually, that never really went through my mind, because to be honest, I thought I was going to be at January camp, so I was doing all the fitness and getting prepared for it beforehand. And when I didn't get a call, or I didn't, when I kind of assumed, oh man, I'm not going to go, maybe like a week or two before that, I just shifted it into, all right, I'm going to be in preseason fitness mode. And so,
yeah.
I mean, I was still in good shape, so I was not that worried. When I got the phone call, I was more excited, like, all right, I'm ready, let's go.
So you were ready. You had kind of planned on that. Your offseason was geared around, I'm going to be ready if I get that call.
Exactly, yeah. That was my thought process on that.
Now, in reading some interviews, it says that you got a voicemail from Jurgen. Where were you that you could not take a call from the U.S. men's national team coach?
I was in the other room.
Wow.
My phone's on silent. I don't normally, there's not a lot of phone calls for me, so I just plug my phone in when I get back from practice and just leave it there. And, you know, I come back in with a voicemail. I'm like, all right, who called me? It's not a number I know. I listen to the voicemail, and the first thing you hear is, hi, Matt, it's Jurgen. And I was like, oh, geez. And like after that, I heard, we need you to come in because, you know, somebody's injured. And then after that, I didn't really hear much else because I was like so shocked.
So had you talked to Klinsmann before this?
Never, no.
Okay, so I'm thinking to myself as you get that voice or that call, for me, if I don't know the number, I don't answer it. So maybe you go, I don't know who this is. Write to voicemail. But you were in another room. At any point did you think to yourself, oh, this is a guy, this is one of my boys doing a quasi-German Southern California accent on me and screwing with me a little bit?
Oh, no, definitely. It's pretty clear when he starts talking that it's actually him. And I looked up the number afterward just to be sure.
That's got to be a thrill, and it's got to be awesome. But it's somewhere in your head, you got to be thinking to yourself, dude, Jurgen, where you been the last year? Haven't you seen? It's about time you called me. I've been waiting on this phone call.
I mean, that was probably what I was thinking before the phone call. But after that, I was like, well, finally, now I can go, you know, prove myself.
Exactly. And so I was mentioning how Stephen Keel was bragging on you last year. I want to give you a chance to brag on somebody else. And that person is Walker Zimmerman. How far behind you is he? And what can we expect from him as he starts to mature into a full professional player?
He's not that far behind at all. I mean, he's a great player, and he's been able to stay healthy for a while now. So that was one of his main, I think, issues. And that's all, like, playing wise, he's one of the best center backs that I've seen in a long time. And so if he can get on the field and stay healthy, I think the sky's the limit for this guy.
Yeah, and I don't mean to insinuate that there's a ranking system. It's just, you know, in the life cycle, you're a little older, you're a little further along in your development, and that's what I meant by how far behind is he. And in your opinion, it's just a matter of staying healthy and getting out there and getting minutes.
Yeah, I mean, because once he gets out there and gets an extended run of minutes early, we'll see what he's capable of, and because we see him practice all the time.
Yeah, of course. I was driving home yesterday and I saw a Charger, and I thought to myself, oh, that's a really nice muscle car. I feel like, and I don't own a muscle car, but I feel like I'm a Challenger guy. I know you are a Mustang man, so if you could, sell me on the Stang over the Challenger, Charger, or even the Camaro.
Well, listen, the American muscle cars, I can't really change your mind if you're one guy or the other. I mean, I respect the Challenger guys, there's Camaro guys, there's Mustang guys. So, I mean, you gotta go with what you like.
Okay, Matt, but
I'm a Ford guy.
But what I'm asking you is not of, hey, I'm from Dallas, I got to be an FC Dallas fan. It's a, hey, I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, but I'm looking for an MLS team. Sell me on FC Dallas. So you're talking to a clean slate guy who's never owned a muscle car, but is starting to think maybe I do want a muscle car. Why the Mustang?
Oh, man, you're putting me on the spot for the sales pitch, huh?
all Mustang owners across the world are now relying on you to bring another into their family.
Oh, man.
Why the Stang, Matt? Why?
Because I didn't want a heavy boat car. The Challenger, the Camaro, all those cars, 4,000 pounds. That doesn't scream muscle car to me. I want a 5-liter V8 with 425 horsepower, 6-speed manual transmission. And I want to throw the car around, and with a light car, rear-wheel drive Mustang. I mean, what else can you want from that? It's loud, it's fast. I mean, it's a Mustang. It's America.
I literally almost teared up at the end there. Thank you. It's Mustang. It's America. I really feel like Ford needs to use that in their next campaign. It's a Mustang. It's America.
Yeah, I mean, call me up. Give me a Ford GT. I'll be your spokesman.
I love how you were like, you hemmed and hawed for like 10 seconds and then shifted into a full on presentation of why the Mustang is awesome. Well done.
You put me on the spot. I had to do something.
Is your Stang a stick?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, Matt, let's not act like everybody in the world is a big stick shift guy. I'm a manual transmission man myself. It's getting harder and harder to find a car that comes in a stick. So I'm very happy to hear that.
Oh, I agree with you. That's one of the first stipulations when I'm looking at cars. Like, can I get this car in a stick? Because my last car was automatic. It was I loved my last car, but it was automatic.
Automatic.
I didn't really know, like, stick, is it going to be for me? But after like 3 weeks, I've gotten Mustang. I'm like, all right, every car I have to get from now on is going to be a stick.
How much of an eye roll does the salesperson give you when you say, hey, do you have any manuals on the lot?
Oh, geez. No idea.
I had a car once where that was a manual. I said I want a manual, and they said, we don't have any in a lot. We'll have to get one shipped, literally put on a ship and sailed up from South Carolina to Washington, D.C. so that I could have it. Literally on a ship. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to find them now.
Even in Texas, because I thought maybe it's an East Coast thing and how, you know, people sit in traffic, so they probably want an automatic. I thought maybe in America's heartland, there would be a lot more stick shifts.
Oh, yeah. There's more sports cars here because you don't have to worry about the bad weather all the time.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think it's a little bit easier to find here, but like in Indiana, it's like impossible.
Yeah, and I do understand, but it does make me sad because every time I go to buy a new car, I look at the list, and literally last time I looked, which was 2 years ago, there were 13 cars that are made in America that you can buy in a manual transmission. 13 brands, styles.
Yeah.
Makes me sad.
I mean, it's rough, but now I just have to like research for a long time online to find a car that's a stick shift. Like Ford has a new one. The RS, the Focus RS, is coming out like a stick, and I have to look at it now.
Of course,
it's a stick.
Of course,
yeah, that's what we're down to.
Exactly. Speaking of things that make me sad, I don't know about you, but are you sad at the decline of actual history shows on the History Channel?
Oh, you have no idea. The History Channel is like, I don't know what they're doing with it, but like it used to be my favorite channel without a doubt.
Easily.
Now it's like reality shows.
And I don't understand. Like TLC, you can go, okay, they're all reality shows and it's not the learning channel anymore, but they call it TLC so it could be whatever it wants. You still call the channel History, yet there are zero history shows on the History Channel.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, they have another history that like H2 or History 2, which is actual history shows.
Not in HD, Matt.
Why would you not make H2 the show, the TV channel with like all the reality shows, and then keep the original programming on the History Channel?
Yes. It bothers me to no end that I have to go to standard def for H2 and Military Channel to get my history documentaries.
Yeah, and even Discovery Channel is the same way. It's starting to go into like reality shows there too.
Your favorite history show show is what? And I'm not talking about the reality shows. I'm talking about the legit history shows.
I mean, it could be Band of Brothers was a series.
Well, that was fantastic. Yeah. Well, no, it doesn't count, and Vikings doesn't count either, which is also a spectacular show. But which? So I'll tell you. Do you remember those the Real West shows with Kenny Rogers as the host?
No, I don't remember that.
That's good. Civil War Journal is also a. Which one of the documentaries do you enjoy watching on the History Channel?
Modern Marvels is pretty good, but I don't think that counts.
Modern Marvels is solid though. Command Decisions, where they tell you what happened in the battle, and then they ask you to choose what Patton what did in this situation.
That one was a good one.
That's
I
a good
liked
one.
That one.
Yeah. Tanks.
I think they were all good, to be honest. I watched them all. That was the only channel I watched.
Yeah, it's fantastic to just turn it on and then kind of do other things, but always keep your eye on the TV and like, oh, what's going on?
Because
you're learning.
Background noise. You're learning stuff while you're doing it.
Exactly. It's perfect. It's perfect. Not perfect is your FIFA Ultimate Team score, which we have to decide. We have to get up, man. I think that should be the goal for the 2015 season. Championships are great. MVPs are awesome. Getting your score up is probably the number one goal.
Absolutely. Number one priority.
Matt Hedges, thank you, man. I appreciate you taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun.
That's one of your front runners, or your early season, your preseason, if you will, favorites for Defender of the Year, Matt Hedges of FC Dallas. I don't know if you heard him or not, but he said it was a lot of fun, which I'm going to take as a ringing endorsement of Pitch Pass and another reason why you need to tell all your friends about the show. So please spread the word about the show. Moving on, one of my favorite guests is from Planet Football. That would be Sports Illustrated's soccer wing at SI.com. He broke some more news this week, which we'll talk to him about, and some other things as well. The news, of course, I'm talking about is the Minnesota United MLS rumors. He broke that, and he joins us right now on the show. Well, before we get to that, Brian Strauss, happy beginning of MLS season to you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad there is a season.
Exactly.
So a few days before the game there, we felt like there may not have been one. So, happy there's a season. Happy I've gotten to go to a couple games so far, and we're just getting warmed up.
Usually, Brian, when you and I talk, we bop around to maybe seven or eight topics. I don't want to do that today, but I do want to get your first impressions of the season. But here's the thing, though, Brian. As it pertains to, like, so I'm watching the matches over this week and last week, and I'm seeing, you know, the horrendous start that New England Revolution is getting off to, and I'm like, wow, they're in trouble. But then I thought to myself, we were saying that about the team as late as June and July last year, and they ended up in the MLS Cup and were the hottest team in the league when they got there. So my question to you is, and I guess this is more of a philosophical one, is, these matches don't mean anything right now at this point in the season, so I'm not going to get too high or too low at my favorite team's results or lack of results. What can we do to make these teams or these matches mean something? Because I don't want to deal with playoffs. I'm an American. I want playoffs. But I do want matches to mean something throughout the course of the season, even at the beginning of the year.
Wait, so the Revs are your favorite team?
No, they are not my favorite team.
The Revs lost, I think at one point last season, the Revs lost 42 games in a row. Right?
I think it was that point, give or take.
Right. And at the end, they were a goal from winning the whole thing. It's a fascinating question. It's something that the league certainly grapples with. I don't always think they grapple with it with much grace. On one level, while the matches may not have that much meaning or impact in terms of who eventually wins trophies, I still get the feeling from watching some games, from having gone to a couple, that people are having a good time. Good crowds, good atmosphere. People are excited. People enjoy having a day out and watching soccer. And so on that level, I think that's fantastic. And I think people lose sight of that it's really about a big part of what this league and what this sport is about is having that experience and that gathering and that camaraderie with your fellow supporters and your club and your community. And that stuff happens. And so that's good. I mean, I was at Yankee Stadium for NYCFC's opener, and there were 40,000+ people there, and the vast majority of them seem to be enjoying themselves. And so that's a good thing.
It's a great point. And I was at RFK for the United Impact match, which, you know, a lot of people outside who just looked at the result or maybe watched on TV was like, wow, what a snoozer. I actually enjoyed myself. I thought it was a really good game. Now, I was there live and in person, but I think that goes back to what you're saying is, look, we're enjoying the matches. A lot of the matches have been very, very easy on the eyes, and at this point in the game, that's enough.
Thanks for stopping by and saying hi.
I don't get to the press box, my friend. I don't have the passes.
Now here's the other thing. Now that's the feel good part. The serious part is that MLS's absurd playoff format continues to undermine the regular season.
Agreed.
And it continues to get worse. And so the way to make these matches mean more is to get rid of aggregate goals, get rid of away goals. Give the teams that finish high. I'm with you. I love playoffs. They're fun to watch. You know, if you've ever played in a playoff game, you know it's different. You know that the tension and the competition and the stress ratcheted up. A fair playoff is a true test of a champion. But MLS's playoff format undercuts the regular season because it offers no advantage to the higher seed. It doesn't force the lower seeds to climb a higher hill. It's aggregate away goal. Take away any home field advantage the higher seed had to begin with, which MLS said forever was the 30 minutes of extra time. Now away goals pretty much done away with that. So they continue to undercut their own message that these games are important with their sort of free-for-all, everyone has the same shot playoff format.
Yep.
So, you know, maybe it's fewer teams in the playoff. It certainly needs to be, the playoff certainly needs to afford the higher seed a genuine, legitimate home field advantage. And then I think you'll see teams care more about whether they finish in second or sixth.
You seem to be on an interesting non-soccer-specific stadium tour. For week one, you're at RFK. Week two, at your Yankee Stadium. I assume you'll be at Citrus Bowl at some point, and also you'll be at Gillette Stadium, CenturyLink. You'll knock them all out. It's very nice.
I've been covering the whole Minnesota thing. You know,
exactly.
The Vikings not only wanted to put an MLS team in a football stadium, but they wanted to put one in a stadium with a fixed roof, which no other team has to deal with. There is no right way, I suppose.
So let's get into the Minnesota stuff in a second. I want to focus on NYCFC.
Sure.
I'll take the positive point of view before I start looking at it from different angles. It looked good on TV. I was expecting horrible sight lines. I was expecting kind of funky when Kansas City played at that minor league stadium kind of views on television.
Oh, yeah, right.
It looked good on TV. You were in the house. How did it play live?
I would guess the press box seats are probably the worst seats in the stadium for soccer because they are along the third base line but angled toward home plate. So we were sort of staring at, you know, we were oriented toward the goal, you know, where Villa scored in his first goal. So, it was not ideal. But it wasn't bad at all. I mean, it was just different. I mean, yeah, the field was a bit further away, and if you're not watching these teams day in, day out, there were a couple guys on NYCFC where you're like, wait, who's that again?
Yeah.
You know, because you're a little bit of far away to sort of figure out who's who. You get used to it over time. But if we were in the worst seats in the place and the view was still kind of halfway decent, then everyone else, you know, people behind the goals, people along the, I don't know, in the outfield, I think it was okay. And again, it's not ideal. It's not perfect. NYCFC has a ton of work to do in terms of figuring out where they're going to play long term. You know, it's important to note that this deal with the Yankees is basically a series of 1-year deals. So at any, you know, at the end of the season, if the Yankees need to back out or want to back out, they can. NYCFC is still up against it in terms of figuring out sort of their permanent future. But again, in terms of the game day experience, other than what I heard were horrendous security lines because, you know, the genteel baseball people weren't prepared for, you know, a horde of soccer orcs storming the battlement. Other than that, it was a nice day out. The view was good. The game production was good. It's a nice stadium. It really wasn't that bad. I think people, you know, other than worrying about the future of the club, I think people that are trying, if you try too hard to find something negative, you'll find something negative. But it really wasn't that bad.
Yeah,
the box is gorgeous. Good food, too.
And I think that's you hit on the key. If I know, for instance, I'm a first year DC United season ticket holder. I know that there is an end date to me schlepping to RFK for weird, not sight lines, but the no heights. So I have trouble seeing because the stands aren't high enough.
The grade is so shallow.
The grade, yeah. Exactly. So I know there's an end date. So for me, it's no big deal because I go, okay, I'm going for this year. Next year is this farewell season. Third year, I'm in a stadium. Will this Yankee
stadium? If you know there's going to be a raccoon in your seat when you get there,
you're fine with it.
That are surprised.
Exactly.
Is in your seat.
But if I'm at Yankee Stadium or worse, somewhere down the line, TBD, is that in some way going to inhibit what I'm going to be doing moving forward with this club?
We've been joking that we were joking in New York that they're going to be playing in a barge in the East River. You know, it's going to be like that Eric Cantona World Cup commercial where there'll be like chain link fence, you know, and Rottweilers, and they'll be on a floating barge. That's up to fans, right? That's up to whether or not fans, you know, want to make that commitment. And like I said, I think you can find things to stress about. You can worry that they're not going to be able to get anything done. Obviously, losing access to that piece of property next to the stadium that they had hoped to build on. I think it's a parking garage. I mean, that hurts. And I can't tell you what their plans are now. I don't have any insider or information on that. But at the same time, sort of back to what I said at the beginning, It was still a nice day out. It's a decent team. It's an interesting team,
yes,
to watch. They've got some good play. Obviously, David B is class. This kid they drafted, Tyree Shelton,
yes,
is an enormous amount of fun to watch. You know, they got vets like Winger and Grabovoy and people like that. Obviously, Jason Christ, we all know what he's about. So, you know, in terms of an afternoon or an evening, a two-hour game, a comfortable place to watch it. It seems fine to me, and so hopefully that's good enough for people until the club figures out what its next step is. But they've started behind in a lot of ways. But my sense from finally getting to meet some NYCFC staff when I was up there, their communications people, marketing people, community people, things like that, you know, they seem like good people, and they have, you know, they've got some ground to make up. They really sort of left things late. But I was pretty impressed with what they're about and have confidence that they'll get this figured out.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as far as on field, they have nice, interesting pieces. They're going to be an interesting team to watch. Their coach obviously has got a lot of pedigree. You've got Villa that you can always rely on. Midsummer comes, you can start trumpeting up Lampard. There's a lot that you can hang your hat on if you're an NYCFC fan. I don't care about the uniform colors. I don't care that they look like Manchester City. To me, that none of that matters to me. You know, the big key is all this money. Are they going to be able to buy themselves a stadium? And I think that'll be the question, which leads me to the other side of the river, if you will. If I'm a Red Bulls fan right now, I'm very, very annoyed with the league, and I'm very, very annoyed with how things are playing out at the beginning of the season, as if this New York Red Bulls franchise, organization, club is a second fiddle. And if I've been New York or Red Bulls fan the entire time, kind of sitting in the catbird seat, I'm New York, people want to come and play for me, I'm a jewel, I'm a marquee franchise in MLS, they talk about me as a marquee franchise. This is culture shock for me, taking a backseat to a team in my backyard.
I'm still, maybe other people know this, I'm not quite sure why the Red Bulls had the weekend off. I mean, I think to sort of offset, I think a lot of the NYCFC hysteria you know, was magnified through the lens of the Red Bulls not playing at all. And I'm not sure why that was the case. Maybe smarter people do. I think Red Bulls fans are, you know, I think they're in good shape. I think they have a you know, in my opinion, the best stadium in the country to go watch a game in. I mean, you want to talk about sight lines. You want to talk about environment. I mean, Red Bull Arena, it remains fantastic. You have a club in transition, right? I mean, that was always going to happen when someone of the magnitude, you know, both physically and mentally of Thierry Henry leaves. I mean, there was always going to be a transition there. I think Jesse Marsh is a good coach. Well, I mean, obviously we'll see what happens, but, you know, I think perhaps being the big dog, being the marquee only New York team, like you mentioned, I wonder if it didn't make them a little bit complacent. I wonder if it didn't sort of leave them, you know, lacking some initiative to really get out there and do more marketing, to do more connecting with the community, that they maybe they thought things would just sort of fall in their lap because they were the New York team. And so what I hope is going to happen and what I think is going to happen is NYCFC's presence is going to ratchet this thing up, and it's going to force the Red Bulls, you know, to be better and to be more proactive and to sort of get out there more in the community and make their brand and their presence, you know, more of a factor and more impactful. And that can only be a good thing. I just don't see how that's bad. And when you have a market of that size, when you have a market that loves pro sports like New York, and when you have the obvious sort of divide between the Red Bulls and NYCFC, whether it's the tradition or the newcomer, or whether it's about the Hudson River or whatever these clubs can use to differentiate themselves, that's what all great soccer cities in the world have. You know, and that's something New York's used to in other sports as well. So, you know, if Red Bull fans feeling like a second class citizen today, I would say you got 20 years of tradition. You've got a beautiful stadium and this is going to make your club better in the end. And that's the way I look at it.
Where do you pull from if you are Red Bulls? Do you because I was thinking about this driving in. There's really not a huge precedent for what's going on. The New York baseball teams are both in New York, so you pull from the boroughs and try to reach out from there. The football teams are both in New Jersey. The hockey teams, there's three of them, so the New Jersey one is the New Jersey team. Really, the only thing you have is maybe the old Nets-Knicks thing, and even the Nets decided, screw it, we're moving into Brooklyn.
We're moving to New York, yeah.
So if you are the Red Bulls, from a fan base point of view, I'm not sure if you know off the top of your head what their demographics look like and where they pull from now, but do you say, you know what, North Jersey, Central, Trenton and up, that's who we're pulling from here on out?
It's funny. This was something that came up over the weekend talking to some people. And you know, when people mentioned, you know, when Red Bulls partisans would talk about, oh, well, people have no problem coming to Jersey to go to Giants and Jets games.
Yeah.
I don't know if that, I mean, both the Giants and the Jets started in New York, so have, you know, have roots in sort of a generation or two,
yeah,
of fans that remember when they were in the city. And second of all, I don't think the rules apply to football. It's 8 to 10 games a year. It's a whole tailgating marathon. It's the NFL is the behemoth. I don't know if it's really applicable. If I'm the Red Bulls, you know, soccer is massive in New Jersey. So many of the roots of the sport in this country are in New Jersey. You know, Open Cup winners, national team players, you know, everyone from Parks to Miola to Bradley to Reyna, all these guys who have roots in Jersey. There's an enormous market there to draw from. But I also think you refuse to cede, you know, Manhattan. You know, you Manhattan, it's on the path, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's a few miles away. I say you go hard in Manhattan, and there's a lot of people in that city that are sort of right in your wheelhouse demographic, you know, for soccer fans in this country. And you fight NYCFC toe-to-toe. You make that ground zero of this rivalry in Manhattan. And then yeah, I mean, maybe you don't do as much, you know, across the East River. You know, maybe that's not going to be your audience. My sister lives in Brooklyn, and, you know, she and her boyfriend enjoy soccer, and they would maybe go to Red Bull once a year, you know, and mm-hmm. It took all day, you know, to do that. And so, you know, they're the sort of people that may say, you know what, it might be easier for me to get to the Bronx. But between Jersey and Manhattan, you got so many millions of potential fans that you should be fine if you do it right.
In the CBA meetings, and I'm using this as an example to get to my question, who is representing Red Bulls when the owners get together? Is there one person?
This is embarrassing. I should probably, my guess is it might be Marc de Grandpre, their GM, but I
okay,
I
but so that was my, that's
I don't
the,
know for sure.
The big, that's, and that's kind of the thing was to me.
Did Dieter Matisic come fly in and it's going to be very well May. I don't know.
That's kind of my thing is when you think of Red Bulls, you think of a corporation, whereas a lot of these clubs, you think even NYCFC has a figurehead at the top of the city football group. Don't know if the Sheik was at the meetings. But I guess my question is anybody in the Red Bulls camp kind of going to Don Garber and saying, hey, man, we are still a marquee franchise. Can you please stop bending every single rule that MLS has for this competition that we are having in our backyard?
Again, I don't know if that's happening. I think this was. What happened in the last 2 weeks, I think, was a one-time thing. You had Orlando and New York City. I mean, that was the obvious you know, national television opener for the season, right? Via Kaká and 60,000 people in the new teams. I mean, that was a slam dunk. And then you had their home opener. I mean, if I don't think NYCFC is still going to be on the front page of every paper drawing 43,000 fans in August. I don't think it's going to be happening. And I think once the Red Bulls get their season under them and we start to see that team coalesce around the changes they've made, not to mention the fact that it's not like Red Bull has just stopped trying. I mean, they put money, they're starting a USL 2 team. They continue to put money in the academy. They have a new training center that the guys are in. So I don't think they've given up. I don't think they've ceded things. I don't think the league is necessarily, turning their back on the club.
Okay.
I think this was a couple weeks of newness and hysteria and oh my God, look at this new team. And pretty soon it's just gonna be normal again. And I think, like I said, over time, NYCFC is going to force the Red Bulls to up their game, and that's how rivalry should be. The same thing's going to happen to the Galaxy when LAFC finally comes in. It's a good thing.
So your points to me, to Red Bulls, if you're a Red Bull executive, to Red Bull employees, keep calm. We're Red Bulls. Let's ride out this initial wave, and then we'll make sure we'll do our work.
Yeah, and I think the Red Bulls, and I think the whole idea of them not going and trying to replace Henry, so to speak, and hiring Ollie Curtis, hiring Jesse Marsh, I think the idea behind that, and we'll see if it works, but I think the idea behind that is to try to create something a little bit more sustainable, rather than sort of these patchwork collections of DPs and whoever happened to be available. I don't know that the club sort of had a controlling purpose that lasted beyond, like, okay, what can we figure out between now and the next transfer window, right?
Yeah.
And the best clubs in LA, the best clubs in MLS, Freudian slip, have a plan. They have a sustainable philosophy, development style, whether it's through the academies, whether it's through the kind of the players they sign and their scouting pipelines. They have a plan. That's why we see the same teams near the top. I mean, so much for parity, right? There is parity in this league, but somehow Sporting Kansas City, Real Salt Lake, Seattle, we see the same teams sort of rise to the top each season. And credit to the Red Bulls for saying, let's take a step back and let's try to figure out if we can create something a little more sustainable. It's something that's worth trying. And we'll see if Ollie Curtis and Jesse Marsh are the answers. But I think, in the context of the rivalry with NYCFC, they're thinking to themselves, how can we plant our roots a little bit deeper? And that's a good thing.
So you brought up Minnesota United, and you broke the story on SI.com. How's that feel, by the way, Bri, when you break a story? Take us through the stages of emotions you go through.
Well, there's always the "my God, I hope this is right" kind of tension that squeezes your heart into something like a small diamond. it's there are some stories that you break out of the blue. An example of one that I broke out of the blue was the Chivas USA, hiatus mm-hmm. holding thing last year. That was out of the blue. This one, there were steps to it, a lot of steps, and some of those steps I took, and some of those steps other people took. And I'll give you an example. There's a new website in Minnesota called Northern Pitch, sort of an independent site that's brought a bunch of bloggers and writers together, and they built on something that I wrote and mentioned a letter of what was it? They called it a letter of support from MLS. So that's not something I had heard before, but it sort of built on something I'd reported previously. So I knew something was going on, and that was sort of like the smoking gun I needed in a way. So
yeah.
I was able to say, hey, what's the letter of support? Start calling sources and figuring that out. And through that, I was able to get the information that, in fact, there was a signed letter of intent between Bill McGuire and the league. So I don't necessarily ask that question without that Northern Pitch report. And so we all sort of build on the back of each other. So there are different kinds of things. And I guess the emotion is that, you hope your boss sees it and you get to stay employed for another week.
At what point in the process does the terror of, okay, I know we're running this story. It's going live at 3:00. It is 2:15. And I hope I see this nowhere else in the next 45 minutes.
I don't know. I don't know if I thought of it that way.
Oh, that never happens for you. Because that, to me, that's my number one concern is I know my stuff is right. I just don't want somebody to get it out there before I get it out there.
Yeah, I worry more about whether it's right, and I really do. And you talk to as many people as, and I'll give you an example. I mean, this Minnesota thing, I've known for between 2 and 3 weeks, but I didn't have the, you know, I used the term smoking gun earlier. Didn't have the specific, like I couldn't nail down exactly what had happened, what kind of agreement was there. I knew United was in and I knew the Vikings were out, but I knew that intuitively. I needed mm-hmm. the evidence, so to speak. And so when that Northern Pitch story came out, I said, okay, this is where I can sort of, I can launch some questions and some phone calls off of this. And so, you know, it doesn't happen without them, but their report was based on something I'd written earlier about new investment and things of that nature. So in that, and they're great guys. And so, you know, in a way, happy to sort of share that story with them. It's funny. I look at breaking a story or writing a story that generates a bit of traction, kind of similarly to the way I thought of scoring a goal when I was a player. And I was a really twisted kind of player, and maybe I'm a twisted kind of writer as well, in that to me it's less celebration than it is relief. You know, I scored a goal, so my coach won't bench me. I'll get to start the next game.
Yeah.
You know, it was always sort of an escape. You know, like thankfully I did this thing, and now I've demonstrated that I can stick around for a little while longer. So yeah, you break a story, you write a story people like, and that's exactly the way I feel. I feel okay. I've you know, prove myself for this week, and now I have next week to prove myself again.
It's funny,
and to try to stay employed or stay on the team or stay wherever it is you're trying to stay.
It's funny that you do say that, because you know, my first reaction is, God, man, you're one of the best in the biz. This is what you do. This is your bread and butter. You got cred. You've got tenure at this point. But then I think to myself the same way, because when I get good ratings here at the radio station, it's like everybody's like, hey, good job, awesome, and in the back of my head, I'm thinking, all right, well, I got some job security for the next 6 months, but after that, I've got to put another big number up. That's all I'm thinking about.
It increases expectations.
Exactly. Right?
And the other thing is this, is that I think on some level you need this kind of personality to get you to where you want to go. I think in that way it helps.
Yeah.
But then once you kind of get there, it can become kind of exhausting. And then on top of that, I mean, you're at DC 101. I'm at Sports Illustrated. These are big brands. These are big markets or you know, big outlets. And
yeah.
And you know, it's the equivalent of playing, you know, when you're on the Yankees, when you're on Real Madrid, the expectations just increase. You know, the demand for consistent performance just increases. So, you know, for people who think, oh, you're at DC 101, you can coast. No, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly the opposite. And so, you know, I like I said, I look at something like this as, you know, hopefully my boss gives me a, you know, because I get beat. You get beat all the time too. You
yes.
know? So you're keeping track of when you get beat and when you win, and you hope that you know, you've got some checks in the positive column that you know, keep the paycheck coming for another week.
What do you think our timetable is for Minnesota United? Since we've got the two more teams coming in 2017. Are they 18 or?
Yeah, maybe 20. I mean, introducing an expansion team is not easy. The expansion draft is very disruptive, and the teams and owners hate it. And I've joked with some people, like, you know, you should offer to, you know, I've joked with Sacramento about this. You should offer to come in without an expansion draft. You know, tell them you won't take any of their players. They'll love you for that. They'll vote for you simply based on the fact that you're willing to come in without an expansion draft. You bring your team, you sign a couple DPs, and you hit the field with what you got, and you see what happens. So it's disruptive in terms of rosters. It's disruptive in terms of scheduling. And so you're not going to add, like, four expansion teams in 1 year. It's just too much. So
I think you bring up a great point. If you did say that, because I heard you say that when you were on in Salt Lake earlier in the week, and I thought to myself, well, that's not going to work, because you expounded on it further, saying, look, we'll take our USL team and just move it up and play at MLS. And I was like, well, they're going to suck. But I guess you're banking on the goodwill of the first year. But with the new CBA in place, you could sign free agents. I mean, they're all going to be older, but you could sign them. You could trade international allocation money, international slots through the draft, through your DPs. You could put a manageable team on the pitch first year without an expansion draft in the upcoming MLS with the CBA in place.
Yeah, and if you're Sacramento and you just want to get in, you just need to get your foot.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's just for fun. It's probably not going to happen that way, but it's just kind of, it was just kind of, you know, bullshitting with, you know, talking about that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, I mean, Minnesota, you know, needs to build a stadium. They're now on the hook, Minnesota United, for a stadium. And you know, obviously have some very well-heeled investors there who are going to help finance the thing. But, you know, there's a lot of things that are still fluid. We don't know, you know, I mean, LAFC continues to look at the site of the, you know, the sports arena where the Clippers used to play. And maybe they get that, maybe they don't. There's a lot of red tape to deal with in California. So do they start in 2017 at the Rose Bowl or a temporary facility, or does the league say, you know what, we can't screw up in LA again. We got to get this right. You know, we're going to take our time and open this team up in a new facility. And so maybe that bumps LA back 2018, 2019.
Yeah.
I mean, Sacramento's and Miami, you know, who knows, flip a coin. So Sacramento's whole argument here is like where we, when you tell us to start digging, we can start digging and we can be ready. And so that continues to be sort of their pitch. And there's going to be a lot of fluidity and MLS hasn't promised anyone anything. They haven't, all they ever said is they're going to have 24 teams in 2020. That's all they've ever said. And that doesn't mean a minimum of 24 teams in 2020.
Got it.
So, you know, they are keeping their options open, as they should, quite frankly, because, you know, the barrier of entry now is high in terms of either stadium quality or stadium control. And, you know, they want to make sure these teams get it right.
Let's wrap up with some sad news or at least some disturbing news, potential news in the league, and that would be Eddie Johnson. Stephen Goff of Washington Post last couple of days has kind of given some updates saying that the, you know, reading between the lines, it doesn't look very good for him to continue playing soccer, at least at this level. I know that Goff's been covering a story. You've been focusing on some other things, but I did want to ask you some questions about what it means for MLS, what it means for DC United, what it means for the player. You know, when I first read it and then read the quotes from Ben Olsen, I kind of was agreeing with Ben Olsen in the sense of, look, it's a very sad situation, but on the other hand, this isn't a 22-year-old kid who's got his whole career in front of him. Eddie Johnson has had a very nice, very lucrative, very long soccer career. If this is the end, he's got nothing to hang his hat on or wonder what if. He's had a really, really good run.
Yeah, I think there's a couple what ifs with Eddie Johnson.
But the what ifs have nothing to do with health related concerns.
Health, right. I mean, you know, look, without the what ifs about Eddie Johnson, he would be someone else, right?
Yes.
The what ifs about Eddie Johnson are because Eddie Johnson.
Yes.
Right. So he has been an enormous amount of fun. That's all I can say. Whether he is infuriating or fantastic, he can be invisible. He can take over a game. You know, his salary range over the years is amazing.
It's ridiculous,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's been a roller coaster. And you talk to people who've met him and talk to people who've played with him. You know, you could write a book of Eddie Johnson's stories. Some of them that'll your jaw will hit the floor. And some of them, he honestly, and I've experienced this firsthand, he can be the sweetest guy. He really can be a thoughtful, you know, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. Just easygoing, amenable person. I spent a day with him in Seattle when he was with the Sounders and drove to Starfire, their training complex in Tukwila, which is just a fun word to say. And he, like, not only did he, I mean, I was promised like 20 minutes with him, and I swear I got 2 hours or more. I mean, he wanted to talk. He wanted to show me around. I mean, he just couldn't have been nicer. And then there are other times where he blows off the media like your mosquitoes, you know, and he's done things to infuriate teammates. Obviously, there were some people in Seattle not sad at all to see him go. But I think, I don't know, the guy, he means well in a way. He's so desperate to prove himself and so desperate to be wanted. And sometimes that comes out in a nice way, and sometimes it comes out in kind of a crazy way. But, you know, I've heard of stories of him doing a lot of really nice, kind things. And at this point in his life, he's got kids. You know, he's divorced, but he's got kids, and he, you know, I think he's in a new relationship, and he's got a family to take care of, and You know, I mean, he's not going to another World Cup. He's not going to be the centerpiece of the focal point of a team again. So I think we understand Benny's point.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a big if. But if he managed his money correctly, this isn't one of your MLS guys who, you know, was making under 100 for 6 years and then just over 100 for a few years. He made good enough money that he should be okay moving forward financially. Side note, I was thinking to myself, you know, you're at SI. Grant's got the Beckham experiment. When does Brian Strauss write his book? But then I thought to myself, well, what will be the subject? And I know you've probably kicked it around. I know you won't share him with him because you got to write the book. But I was thinking about subjects, and I was like, there's probably not a lot of subjects. Eddie Johnson would be a fantastic book subject, like 15 years from now. Like,
are you kidding, dude? That's a 30 for 30.
Oh, my God. It'd be great. Because to me, he's like the Bad News Barnes. Remember the AVA guy because we were too young to see. But you hear stories about, wait, that guy played basketball after he did this, this, and this? That's crazy. In 10 years, people will be saying that about Eddie Johnson.
When I was playing, I used to make a joke that if there was a 10-yard dash in the Olympics, I would have been in it. And then every distance beyond that, I got logarithmically worse. I was really fast over short distances. And so people who ran track were like freaks to me, right?
Yeah.
And then marathons, I'd rather go to prison than run a marathon. Like, I can't even conceive of that. And that's the way I feel about writing a book. Like, I'm on this show now announcing I will never write a book.
Oh, come on.
I will never write a book. I am a sprinter. I will never. I have enough trouble with these 3,000-word epics that I've got to write once in a while for SI. No, believe me, a book's never happening. But Eddie Johnson is a fascinating character. And I'll say this as well. I mean, if this is the end for Eddie, and part of me, in a way, and I hope this doesn't come across wrong, part of me hopes it is, because if he really –
yes.
I mean, large heart, you don't screw around with that. And, if they can't find a way to get him on the field safely, then I hope this is the end, and I hope he takes care of himself, and I hope he puts his health and his family first. But I think it's important that for all of the absurd ups and downs of his career, that people don't forget 2013 and how, you know, when a U.S. national team was sort of teetering on the brink, somehow Eddie Johnson came from nowhere and scored a bunch of big goals and in qualifying and helped them win the Gold Cup, and really, really helped. It was a big part of the reason that team stabilized in 2013 and then flourished and won the Gold Cup and finished first in the Hex. And I think Eddie should have been in camp for the World Cup. I mean, I think especially after Jozy Altidore went down, you know, where was a guy who could sort of menace opposing center backs? Where was a guy who could win something in the air? Where was a guy with a bit of athleticism who could sort of stretch things? The U.S. didn't have that in Brazil once Jozy went down. And I think Eddie got a bit of a raw deal not getting a shot at least the 30-man camp in Stanford. And I hope people don't forget what he did in 2013.
Yeah, and, you know, people focus so much on Landon and the raw deal he got. Eddie's raw deal kind of got lost in the shuffle, because you're right. Going in, he was maybe one of the hottest goal scorers pre-camp, and he doesn't even get invited to the camp, which you know, kind of makes you scratch your head as well.
And he offered something that other guys didn't.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he offered a physical presence and a bit of experience up top. I mean, you know, Clint Dempsey was out of position. Michael Bradley was out of position. You had things not quite right once Jozy went down. And of course, you can't predict the guy's going to, you know, do his hamstring 20 minutes into the tournament. But, you know, at that point, when you see Jozy lying on the field, I guarantee you, every one of us in the press box in the towel was thinking, man, you know, Eddie Johnson would be a guy, a nice guy to bring off the bench right now. So, I mean, it's a sad story. And then obviously what happens with DC United? I mean, you've got a DP charge now, not to make light of Eddie's situation, but, you know, DC has a season to play, and they've now got a significant chunk of their salary budget in that max DP charge tied up in a player who may never step on the field. Oh. That's a problem.
Okay. I'll take the other side of the coin and go, Eddie was, at best, if everybody's healthy, your first offensive sub off the bench. Look, the money is the money, and, you know, as a fan, I'm not paying the money, so it doesn't matter to me. It's a sunk cost at that point. What do you say for on the pitch purposes? How is that a big loss, or how big of a loss is it for DC United?
we don't know because we don't know which, you never know which Eddie's going to show up, right?
And that's the thing, yeah.
Which is part of the fun, unless you're Ben Olsen. And then you've got to figure out. I mean, if the Eddie of 2013 shows up, then he's worth the money, and he's a guy who can put you on a run. You know, you become a contender with an in-form Eddie Johnson. But with an out-of-form Eddie Johnson, then yeah, then you're right. He's a sub off the bench when you need a goal. And Arrieta looks good so far. You know, if you're DC, you like what Arrieta brings to the table, and you think that between him and Pontius and Chris Rolfe and Nick DeLeon, that you've got some attacking elements there that can threaten teams. So, you know, there is no easy answer to this question other than, wow, you'd really like to have that $360,000,
yeah,
you know, to
slot.
Play with this summer. And instead, you're likely not going to have it. You know, Stephen Goff in his story, you know, reminded us that, you know, I mean, I remember that you could buy out a contract, but I had forgotten that you have to do it before the season starts. So, you know, if MLS grants DC United some kind of hardship exemption and lets them buy out this contract, all the other teams are going to throw a fit, you know. So, you know, how do you decide what's a medical exemption and what isn't? I mean, all injuries are medical exemptions in a way, right? So it's a complication, and it's something DC is going to have to deal with. But they don't have a lot of leeway now to spend over the summer. And it, you know, they're not going to finish first again. I mean, this is going to be a tight season for DC. And I think we're going to see, you know, we're going to have to see a lot more 1-0 wins for them to, you know, like we saw against Montreal, for them to be a threat.
I feel like, and please don't tell me that you are saying this, but I feel like you're saying DC United fans, they were bringing in Cristiano Ronaldo to fill that DP slot, and now they won't be able to thanks to the system. I think you're saying that.
My esteemed colleague Grant wrote that Cristiano wants to come in 2018.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
By then, United will be comfortably ensconced in their Buzzard Point Palace. And I don't know if Cristiano is aware of the existence of Washington, D.C. You know, I think a lot of these guys from Europe think that there are three cities in the United States. You have New York, you have Los Angeles, and you have wherever Disney is.
Yes.
And that's where they want
to go. Cristiano Ronaldo knows where Miami is, Brian. Please. He knows how to get to South Beach.
It's that suburb of Disney in Florida. So that's where these guys want to come play. So if you're, you know, and that's what's funny is there's been no difference between D.C. and Chicago, which are massive markets, and Columbus and Salt Lake and Portland, which are much smaller. As far as the Europeans are concerned, we may as well be Salt Lake City. So.
I guess my real point in that joke was I don't see them going out and sign, like, even if they had the exemption and were able to do it, I don't see them signing a DP or somebody worth over $300,000 to a deal this summer. I just don't think that's happening.
You don't think they'd use that cap space if they had it?
I don't.
Wow.
I don't. So, I mean, are you saying if tomorrow it came out, look, it's forgiven, it's off the books, you have to pay them, but the cap space is yours to fill as you want. You think United goes out and signs a $350,000 deal with somebody?
Maybe they go out and sign a $200,000 deal with somebody. I don't know. I don't know what they do, but I think they don't just, you know, light that money on fire. I mean, I think they do something.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think last year was last season, and you know, when I wrote about United and the stadium effort, I said this myself to Ben Olsen and Jason Levien and those guys. I mean, I thought last season was one of the great clutch performances in MLS history.
Yeah.
With a stadium on the line,
yep,
with the future of the club on the line, that team, absent kind of real stars, right, absent transcendent,
yeah,
you know, marquee names, went out and finished in first place. When they had to generate momentum, when they had to get crowds in the building, when they had to do things to demonstrate their relevance, to prove to the city council that they mattered in this city and that they could attract attention, they went out and finished first.
Yeah.
A year after winning three games. I mean, that's a massive accomplishment, and it should be celebrated, and it really made a difference in terms of them getting that stadium. So the pressure's off now a little bit, and I'm sort of, I mean, obviously they want to get back to the playoffs. Obviously they don't want to have too big of a fall off, but I think we're back now in a way, and I'm agreeing with you in this sense, we're in a way to where, hey, let's focus on getting this stadium done, and
yeah,
let's you know, tread water where we can until we sort of figure out, you know, how to get into the new stadium and what the revenue is going to look like and things like that. At the same time, they're spending money. They're spending money on the academy. There's been talk of a logo kind of tweak. Jason Levien mentioned that to me back in the fall, last fall when I met with him, that they're looking into that kind of stuff, just thinking about refreshing the brand. So they are making some investments here and there. But, yeah, I don't think you're going to see them, you know, blow millions on a player until they're in that new stadium and they look at what the economics look like.
I think, by the way, I encourage everyone to go to SI.com, Planet Football in general. But while you're there, I loved your little breakdown of everyone's home and away unis this year. It was fantastic. It's fantastic. Definitely check that out, no matter who you're a fan
of. People love it. It's amazing. Like you get a million people looking at that thing. I mean, it's just incredible. Like, you spend a week laboring over like a really complex story, and you know, when your mom reads it, and then you throw up 100 words on why San Jose's uniforms suck, and my gosh, it's really funny how much people love that.
I love pictures and I love blurbs. That's how it should be.
And seamless slideshows. You don't even have to link to the page to reload. It does it right inside. The conceit behind that was that when teams always put out just the shirt. Here's the new jersey.
Yeah.
And I've been talking to MLS for a couple of years. Sean Dennison at MLS is their corporate communications guy about how come they don't put pictures of the whole uniform?
Yeah.
I mean, and I even mentioned in the intro, like Liverpool and Manchester United both wear plain red jerseys, but Liverpool's all red uniform is way different than United's, you know, red shirt, white shorts, black socks.
Yep.
It's a completely different brand and a completely different look. So it took Adidas forever to come up with those kind of images, and then they still couldn't get us images of the ones that weren't new. So we had to like basically Photoshop and sort of create images of the existing uniforms. And then, God love Adidas, they got a couple of their own uniforms wrong. An example was they sent us the Kansas City's new kit. Where they send us an all sky blue version, and then Kansas City takes the field wearing navy shorts, and I buzz the guy, I know it's Sporting, and I'm like, what happened here? And he's like, yeah, we kept telling Adidas we're wearing navy blue shorts. I don't know what their problem is.
Geez.
I'm like, great, thank you. But yeah, overall, people love that stuff.
But you know, one of the cool things, and you're right, because you usually just see when they have the jersey unveiling, it's just the tops, and you pointed out a few times in these blurbs, a lot of the interesting things in these uniforms happen in the socks. So seeing the socks with the unis was very, very cool.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed I've coached a couple teams, but the main team that I coached for a few years, we wore navy jerseys, navy shorts, and white socks as our home uniform, kind of like Chelsea, but with a dark navy instead of the royal blue. And I thought those 14-year-olds looked great in those kits. I thought they were really sharp. So it's the whole package, and it was fun. On a serious level, I think, you know, it's fun to rip teams for their dumb uniforms. I mean, that's just kind of blowing off steam, and it's fun. But I think on a serious level, you're still talking about branding. You're still talking about, do these clubs have resonance? Do people care about, you know, is it still just about MLS this, MLS that? Or do people really have a sense of what the Colorado Rapids are about? Do people have a sense of what the Columbus Crew are about? When you turn on the TV, do you say to yourself, ah, that's the Houston Dynamo.
Yep.
I understand. I know something about them. And this is still about creating a brand and creating an identity. And uniforms help that. That's why it always bugs me when teams all look the same. Because, you know, you can't – if you turn on the TV and you have no idea who's playing, then how are you going to – how are you going to pull people in, you know?
I eagerly await your first book. I will be holding my breath until...
Have your descendants hold it. Your great-great-great-grandkids will be holding their breath waiting for my first book.
Of course, we're going to have you on throughout the season. Brian Strauss of Sports Illustrated. Thanks, man, as always. Appreciate the time.
You're the man. I enjoyed it.
Show information, go to pitchpass.com.